Colin P. Maguire, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Paul. How are you?
I am okay. So Colin is an ethnomusicologist, martial artist, sharpener of knives, and maker of fabulous shillelaghs. That's how you pronounce it, or do you pronounce it slightly differently? Shillelagh?
Shillelagh.
Yeah, and so Colin is a Canadian scholar, martial artist, and who has worked on various aspects of music and culture. Musicking, as they sometimes say in ethnomusicology, is an expert in styles of kung fu that we're going to find out about, and also has a nice sideline in Irish stick fighting and Irish stick making. So, where shall we begin? Where did you begin? That's the thing. I guess music probably first, but where did the martial arts begin for you?
Martial arts actually came first for me. My parents put me in Taekwondo when I was 6 years old because a friend of mine from school was doing it. And I suppose all the usual reasons that parents put their kid in martial arts for self-defense and discipline and exercise and all that kind of stuff. And I never really looked back. I've been doing martial arts my whole life, tried a lot of different stuff along the way. Kind of settled on Kung Fu eventually with Wing Chun Kung Fu, the Sum Nung style, for those who are familiar with the different branches. And, I had done a master's in composition, in electroacoustic composition. And when I finished, I was teaching some classes at the university where I had done my degrees, and I was practicing a lot of kung fu. And my dad asked me if there was a connection between these very disparate parts of my life. And I said, that is a very good question. And so I started looking into it, and I discovered that there was most definitely some connections between music and kung fu, as well as music and martial arts more generally. And that sort of became the basis of my PhD studies.
Okay, so what was the title of your PhD? What was the main theme? What was the was it about the Chinese stuff, or was it the
It was focused on music movement and meaning in a Chinese Canadian Kung Fu club. And I guess, I showed up at the Kung Fu club with the thought that I was going to do ethnomusicology stuff, that I was going to learn about their music. And they said, they were very happy to share their music with me, but that it was the last thing you learn in the curriculum. And that I sort of needed to be prepared to commit. And I guess it worked out well for me that I was doing the field work in my own backyard in Toronto. So I had the time to do that because, first learning a new style of Kung Fu or a couple of new styles. They do the Hong Luk Kung Fu Club where I did my field work. They do Choi Le Phut and Do Pai and a bit of Hung Gar. And so, yeah, I had to practice their martial arts, and then I had to join the lion dance class. And then you start by learning the tail of the lion. When I say lion dance, maybe I should just explain in case anyone
Yeah, I
who
do.
doesn't know the ritual lion performance with a big mask that goes over the face of the front person and a cape that goes over the back of the second person, and they form this kind of mythical animal, which doesn't really look like a lion because lions are not native to China. Anyway, so yeah, you start learning the tail of the lion, and then you get to learn the head of the lion, and then you get to learn the instruments. And finally, sort of years down the road, I got to learn the drum. So when I was trying to set up for a PhD, it was guided by the transmission process at the Kung Fu Club where I was at. And that really changed the way that I initially went into it to do the research. It made a lot more about the body and about transmission and about the community, and a lot less about sort of taking the music itself, if there is such a thing, and transcribing and analyzing or doing. I did a bit of that kind of stuff, but not as much.
So you, because you came to Cardiff for the conferences a few times, and you have a rather fabulous website, which completely derailed my afternoon, actually, as I just mentioned to you earlier, because you also have this whole music section, which I'm not going to touch, because you're also a DJ and you're also you produce music, and it turns out I like a lot of it. So, but I think I'm interested in talking first about your, not the Shillelagh studies, we'll get to that, but the presentations that you gave about the relationship between Kung Fu performance of forms, Daolu, whatever, and the music. Is there a point on this? Is it on your CV or on your publications where you talk about those presentations? Because there's some films on here as well, isn't there, on this website?
Yeah, I guess I've looked at sort of three main areas, all of which are tied together with the idea of martial sound.
Yeah.
Well, martial sound being the way that we can hear music as martial arts and the way that we can hear martial arts as musicking.
Yeah.
And so there's the Chinese Kung Fu and the percussion music that's used to accompany demonstrations of forms, as well as the lion dance. There's the music of Hong Kong martial arts movies, Kung Fu movies, both on screen and off screen. And then there's the music of 19th century stick fighting in Ireland, which are the sort of three areas that I'm working on underneath the idea of martial sound. There's links to some of the presentation stuff in the blog on the website.
Okay.
There's also links on the publications page to some of the stuff that I've published about these various different areas.
So in the blog section over here, you have links to some of this. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, it's because the reason I wanted to begin with that is because that's the most recent one, isn't it? That you did Bruce Lee's Broken Rhythm and Music.
Yeah.
And this stuff is all great. But tell us about the lesson that you learned about the relationship of the Kung Fu performer to the music at a demonstration or at a display, because it's not a straightforward one, is it? It's not a case of you keep time or you syncopate in relation to time. It's something much more complex and cultural than that, isn't it?
It is. So when the Hong Luk Kung Fu Club does Kung Fu demonstrations, they accompany, well, members of the group will accompany the person doing the demonstration using the same instruments that they use to accompany the lion dance. And those are a giant barrel drum and some handheld cymbals and a flat hanging gong that you play with a stick. Mm-hmm. So there's this very strong rhythmic pull, especially for people who are used to lion dancing, because in lion dance, the lion follows the rhythm and there's very close synchronization between musical beats and the choreography. But when people get up to do these Kung Fu demonstrations, they are meant to be asynchronous primarily,
okay,
which means that you are supposed to not follow the beat. And it doesn't really work very well to just kind of ignore the beat, which some people do try and do. They're just trying to focus on their movement and so they try and forget about the music. And inevitably, when people do that, they end up becoming entrained to the beat because it's such a natural phenomenon natural in human culture. It's a cultural phenomenon that when people hear music, they tend to move their bodies to it, you know, tap your foot to the beat or nod your head or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when instructors tell students that they're supposed to be asynchronous, what I discovered was that that's a relationship between movement and music that embodies a combative approach. And so when people are fighting, if you have two people who are very evenly matched in terms of speed and skill and strength and all those sorts of things, then people can kind of get into a stalemate where someone attacks, the other person defends, the defender counterattacks, the original attacker then defends, and they end up becoming in time with each other because they're able to follow the other person's rhythm And of course, you know, the timing comes apart and comes back together, and people are at a distance and they come back together. But a successful defense means that you are synchronized with your opponent's attack, because you're able to either dodge out of the way or parry or something like that.
Yeah.
So for combat rhythm to be effective, in order to apply a striking technique or a grappling technique, one needs to be able to get around the opponent's defense. And rhythmically, that looks like syncopation. Either you're at the same time, but you're on a different beat, that would be syncopation, or you're out of phase, where you're no longer at the same tempo. You're at the same tempo, and then you move out of phase with your opponent's defenses so that you can land your attack. Mm-hmm. When people are giving a demonstration, the ability to remain asynchronous to the beat is a demonstration of the ability to maintain a combative rhythm. And it's not always 100% asynchronous. Usually at the beginning of the form, there's some kind of a bowing sequence or an opening sequence where the movement is meant to be in time with the percussion.
Okay.
And that is sort of very genteel, and it's showing that there is control and that the group is working together, mm-hmm. and all those sorts of presentational things of the opening. But you know, the majority of a forms demonstration is meant to be asynchronous.
So when you say it's meant to be, does that mean that it's part of the syllabus to learn how to have a more complex relation or resistance to and relationship with the music? Is the music there as a test? It's like, you know, are we in the Shaolin temple with Grasshopper? You know, we're going, try and do your form, but not in time to this music. You know, is it deliberately pedagogically kind of conceptualized, or is this something specific to the Hong Luk Club?
So it's not specific to the Hong Luk Club. Lots of Southern Chinese martial arts groups who have lion dancing also do their demonstrations to percussion music, and they by and large are asynchronous-ish. It is quite a test. That's why I say asynchronous-ish, because a lot of people can't do it.
Yep.
And part of the problem is that people don't practice martial arts with percussion music. That's not normal. That only happens very occasionally. At the Hong Luk Kung Fu Club, for most students, it's once a year at the anniversary banquet. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there might be some performances at Chinese New Year, or you go to a lion dance with the group and the client might ask for a Kung Fu demonstration as well. But for most students, it's really just once a year. And they might get a couple of dress rehearsals before the performance, but really it's this peak experience where, you know, you've been practicing a lot leading up to the anniversary, and you get up on stage and you're supposed to do this demonstration without following the music and merge together your experience from the classes where you work on forms and basic techniques, the classes where you work on sparring and application, which are much more asynchronous. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to get up there and do it in front of 500 people without really having practiced that specifically. So it is quite a test, and there's not a lot of guidance on it, to be honest. It's really a sort of thing where you're, as a student, you're taking things that you've learned in all these different areas and synthesizing them in real time in front of your classmates and your teachers. And
so everyone's just hanging out at this dinner, this gala, this event, and all the teachers and seniors and retired people and their family, and then X number of students take their turn and go up and demonstrate something. So you're being judged largely according to tacit kind of norms and values that possibly aren't explicitly articulated, but someone might go up there and do a terrible job and everyone's got their head in their hands, but they can't quite express what's wrong with it. It's just not right. Is it like that?
It's a bit like that. There's not a lot of explicit discussion about these rhythmic relationships beyond the sort of very surface level, don't follow the drum.
Right.
That's that's kind of as much coaching as you.
Okay. But I mean, that's a good thing. Cause I mean, when I first started Eskrima, my instructor would, I mean, it seemed to me like relentlessly beat me up, but he would always have it. There was always a pedagogical purpose. Like he would do something with his hand that would tell me where to try and hit. And he'd go, you just try to kick me in the balls. But I'd actually just put my hands there in front of my balls, so you couldn't kick me. And he would also get a rhythm going in order only to break it and say, see, you just followed me. I'm doing this and you start doing the same. And it's the whole thing's like the Bruce Lee fight with Chuck Norris in the Coliseum, and which is a segue, isn't it? Because you're next. I mean, this led, as soon as we talk, rhythm, broken rhythm, syncopation, not following the beat and everything, or the relationship with music, maybe with jazz and improvisation and so on. There's a huge figure, there's a huge elephant in the room, and it's Bruce Lee, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think this led you, I'm going to share a screen. So you came to our Bruce Lee conference, and you talked about this. You talked about Bruce Lee's use of musical terminology, his use of terms like timing and rhythm and was it cadence and all the musical terms. And eventually we published it in the journal Martial Arts Studies. But tell me what's your argument about Bruce Lee's use of musical terminology?
Well, anyone who knows Bruce Lee knows that he was very eclectic in his approach to martial arts. He sort of took what was useful, rejected what wasn't, and tried to add what was specifically his own, right?
Yeah.
And I read the Tao of Jeet Kune Do when I was a teenager, and I've read it several more times over the years. And one of the sections that I thought was extremely important, but kind of hard to grasp, was the section on timing, which I guess there's a main section, and then it comes up in a few other places in the book. So it's not really my argument. I mean, it's Bruce Lee's argument, right? Yeah. That if you have the speed and you have the skill and you have the power, then you can just kind of impose your will on an opponent and just, you know, go ahead. But that by and large, if you're facing a skilled opponent, that it's much more helpful to control the pace and rhythm of the encounter so that you can use it strategically. It allows the person who leads the dance to kind of predict a little bit what their opponent is going to do because they're controlling the timing. Mm-hmm. So in his section on timing, with all this eclectic terminology that he drew from dance and military drill and chess and fencing, mm-hmm. and all these kind of different areas, it was just conceptually brilliant, but in terms of the language used and the lack of explanation of really key terms, I found it very difficult to understand. So yeah. in that article, I tried to use music terminology to have a self-consistent way of explaining these different things that he was talking about. You know, a movement time, which comes from fencing, mm-hmm. that is like a musical beat. And then of course the tempo that he talks about, he takes it from chess, where a tempo is your turn to move. But musically, tempo is the rate of the beat or the rate of movement time, sort of mm-hmm. beats per minute. So I tried to clean up his terminology and make it something that it could be applied a little bit easier if people wanted to talk about rhythm in combat, mm-hmm. And everyone would be using the same terminology. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess the idea is that you establish rhythm, kind of like you were saying with your Eskrima teacher, you establish rhythm with your opponent through, you know, movement, through faking, through real attacks. And then you break that rhythm in different ways.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that what Bruce Lee is articulating in the Tao of Jeet Kune Do, do you think that's a novel innovation, or do you think he add, what does he add that specifically his own? I mean, to the discourse of timing and rhythm and so on in combat. Does he add something that you think, I guess the problem is you read that book so long ago, but I think, like, conceptually, does it differ from other discursive approaches to speed and timing and so on in martial arts combat or performance?
I think it does. And what it comes down to with Bruce Lee is not that he was doing anything new. I mean, he's still using punches and kicks, and it's not like he invented a third arm that no one had ever seen before or something like that. It's more that he was able to talk about things in a way that maybe people didn't talk about them very clearly before or hadn't really delved into. So in my experience with martial arts, and, you know, I've done, like I said, Taekwondo, but Judo, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, kickboxing, Kenpo, Tai Chi, fencing, like I've done a lot of other stuff other than Kung Fu. I found that by and large, martial arts instructors don't talk about rhythm in a very clear way. Mm-hmm. And notwithstanding the eclectic terminology that Bruce uses, he does talk about rhythm and timing in a way that's a lot more in depth than what I had found in my training. And, you know, maybe it's possible that there are some fight books that were written in German in the 1600s that I'm not familiar with. I'm not as familiar with the HEMA literature or something. But, you know, it's not talked about very much and not talked about very clearly. Miyamoto Musashi talked about timing and rhythm some in the Book of Five Rings. Mm-hmm. Also in a much more sort of general way. And so, yeah, that's really Bruce's addition to it discursively, is to take something that everyone talks about. I mean, all the martial arts that I've done, teachers do talk about timing and rhythm, mm-hmm. but on a very surface level. And Bruce just kind of drilled down deeper to come up with some strategies and some tactics, mm-hmm. that I think are quite effective.
Yeah. So he tried to bring it out into conscious conceptuality, so that it wasn't just this tacit kind of like, don't follow the drum. It's sort of like more precisely articulate than that. I guess we should spend some time talking about Ireland as well. So Colin Maguire sounds like possibly a Celtic kind of a name. So what's the reason for the interest in and connection to Ireland? You spent quite a lot of time. Is it Cork you were in as a postdoctoral researcher, or and you were researching stick fighting culture and music in Ireland? Is there a family connection, or is it just?
My family, if you trace the paternal lineage back, came from Ireland before Canada. Although more anciently, the family is from Scotland. Mm-hmm. And not to get too deep into genealogy, but in the northern part of Ireland and the western islands of the Highlands of Scotland, there's an ocean which really historically connected them together more than it separated them. Like, there's parts of Ireland where you can see Scotland, and people were back and forth all the time. Yeah. So beyond
that's the classic case study in Hobbes, Bormann, Rangers, the invention of tradition, isn't it? The idea that at a certain point in time, for various kind of cultural and managerial reasons, they wanted to construct separate identities for these supposedly different peoples, the Scottish, the Highland people, and the Lowlanders and the Irish. But actually, for aeons, it had been just people in that area.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do really love the invention of tradition bit about kilts, because I'm a kilt wearer as well.
Yeah.
And it's funny the parallels between all these things that came out in the 19th century or the 18th century that we now view as being so ancient and having extended from time immemorial, which are really fairly recent inventions. Yeah. But we digress.
So what took you to Cork then? What was the sequence of events that took you there?
I got a postdoctoral fellowship from the Irish Research Council to basically turn my dissertation into a book. And the dissertation, as I said, was on percussion music and Chinese martial arts. But there is an expert on Chinese music at University College Cork, the music department. Jonathan Stock is quite an expert on Chinese music. So he was my supervisor, and it was great to go and be able to work with him. The new project was the one on Kung Fu film music. And then after my postdoc finished, I left, went back to Canada for 10 days and turned around and went straight back to Ireland to take up a much smaller grant that I got from the Ireland Canada University Foundation. Their Flaherty Scholarship Program let me go back to start working on Irish stick fighting. And I had known about Irish stick fighting in a very general cultural sense as being, oh, Irish people and shillelaghs, but there really wasn't much. These are sort of very fragmentary cultural connections, I think, that most Irish people in diaspora might have a bit of, but don't know what the connection is between Irish people and shillelaghs and fighting. And sort of the colonialist narrative of it was that, well, Irish people are drunken louts, and when they drink, they fight, and they just use sticks and beat each other up. And there is that kind of, if you look up Irish shillelagh, you'll see images on Google of just kind of aggressive looking leprechauns waving sticks around. It's kind of not a very flattering stereotype. But I did later on, when I was in Toronto doing my PhD, I discovered that there is a bit of a renaissance of Irish stick fighting going on. That there's a family, the Doyle family, who came over from Ireland during the famine to Newfoundland in the far east coast of Canada there. And they had a tradition of stick fighting, which they actually maintained. And there are some other historical records of retentions in other places, but the Doyle family really kept it up and refined it over the years and turned it into a martial art, which Glenn Doyle started teaching outside of the family for the first time in sort of the early 2000s. And I got to train with him and get exposed to it and was quite impressed with what I found, and started looking into it more. And there's a researcher named John Hurley. He's an independent researcher, and he's done a lot of work into it, looking at historical sources, and self-published some books about it. And so I wanted to try and delve into it a bit more academically and take a musical approach to try and find some of the culture of 19th century faction fighting, because that was the height of it in Ireland, was before the famine of the sort of mid 1800s. From about the early 1800s, faction fighting had grown to become this huge phenomenon in Ireland, and quite diverse. I've discovered that there were some situations where it was quite friendly, where they weren't trying to kill each other, they were trying to knock each other's hats off, or just, you know, draw first blood and then it was over, all the way up to, you know, very deadly fights between rival religious or political groups. But that a lot of these occasions involved music. So I did, when I went back to Ireland and did some digging, I did find a song that was apparently used to start faction fights. And it was suitably short, because you can imagine that when you start singing this song, you don't often get to finish it.
So what kind of, I get, what kind of archives, what kind of records, what kind was it? I mean, what were you dealing with, and how did you establish the musical characteristics, or the characteristics of the combat, or the characteristics of the weaponry? I mean, how did you establish things like this?
Yeah, this project is ongoing. So when I went off to Ireland, it was a mad dash to just kind of grab everything that I could find. So I went to county archives, I went to university archives, I went to the national archives. There's a traditional music archive in Dublin. And I found all kinds of stuff. When it comes to music, there were some things that have been passed down through oral tradition. So like that song that was used to start a faction fight, it's in Irish. I did find a couple of recordings of it. There were also things that were written down by tune collectors in the 19th century. So there was a big push in the 19th century to go around and find the traditional music of Ireland and write it down in music notation, document it. And some of those tune books have descriptions of the tunes or how they were collected or when they were collected. There's a lot of tunes that reference things like a blackthorn stick. And when I say tunes, I mean instrumental dance music, jigs and reels, where the title is the blackthorn stick, or there's some of them that are titled and named after the famous, or the biggest and most famous factions, the Shanavests and the Caravats. But, you know, traditional music is a messy thing, and you'll find those tunes under different names. So there's lots of traditional musicians now who might play a tune that has a historical connection to faction fighting. It was either named after one of the factions, or it was perhaps played by those factions as their marching music before battle. And that's the kind of stuff I'm looking into. What are those connections? It's hard to find, because lots of times there's references, say, in an old newspaper that mentions, oh, well, you know, the when these two factions were meeting, they played this tune, but then they don't have a transcription of that tune. And because of the way that the naming conventions, that tune could have been applied to one of several different melodies, or that name could have been applied to one of several different melodies. But one of the big things that I'm interested in here is a practice called wheeling, which occurred before faction fights. And it's sort of a prelude to the fight. It sounds a bit like a warm-up. It sounds a bit like a challenge to the other group. There's some different ways that it seemed to happen. If you're familiar with Muay Thai and the Y crew that fighters do before fighting, where they go and they seal the ring, and they do a dance and pay respect to their teachers and disrespect their opponents. I suspect that it might have been something kind of like that, and it appears to often have been done to music. So I'm also looking into some retentions that are possible in some set dances in Ireland that are still done with sticks. You've seen Morris dancing, then where it is done with sticks as well. There are some things that look a bit like that, but in Ireland, there's some mummer traditions where they use sticks and have dances. So I think that there are some retentions in that way that have become disconnected from stick fighting. Similar to hurling, the Gaelic Athletic Association sport, where apparently a lot of the county and parish level rivalries that were part of faction fighting got folded in to hurling when the Gaelic Athletic Association was founded in the late 1800s. There was a real push in Ireland to gain independence from Britain, and the nationalist movement promoted putting aside these local rivalries and channeling them into hurling to strengthen the body and to then channel that energy towards gaining independence. So there's lots of reasons why stick fighting kind of disappeared. There's lots of retentions that I'm trying to trace, and it's all ongoing and exciting.
No, that sounds great. And so I mean, there's lots I was going to ask about connection with dancing, but I guess is there a fetishization of the material? I mean, would a shillelagh become an heirloom? Would it be like this has been in the would it be like, you know, like in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, this is the green destiny, you know? Is there that kind of thing, or is there no evidence for that?
there is some evidence of it. And I found a poem at one of the county archives, which was previously unpublished. And I just wrote something about it on my blog there after getting permission to share it with the world. Yeah. And in it, it talks about finding a stick, cutting it, how you make a shillelagh, and then it becomes this prized possession. And that's a recurring theme that I've found in a lot of other places, that people spend a lot of time and effort. These weren't just sort of, you know, sticks that were picked up by the side of the road. Mm-hmm. Although there is some evidence of that in faction fighting as well, where people would get involved in these dust-ups and just kind of grab whatever was available and use it. But a shillelagh, in that sense, does become a companion and something that people would have had with them sort of all the time. Like if they left the house, they would have had their shillelagh for out walking about and going to the markets and you know, driving cattle and mm-hmm. lots of situations where having a stick is a very helpful thing. And that, yes, they do get passed on. So you find lots of people in the Irish diaspora who have their fathers or grandfathers or great-grandfathers shillelagh.
Yes, I was. I saw Megan Morris in Australia on Facebook talking about her father or grandfather shillelagh. A wooden weapon was the weapon of choice. Is that because it wasn't life or death, or I mean, were blades a big problem or a big issue in kind of 19th century Irish factional violence? I mean, is it just that the shillelagh becomes kind of fetishized for some reason in folk and knives don't, or what?
There's a lot of reasons for that. Yeah, part of it were the restrictions against owning weapons in Ireland at the time. Mm-hmm. So because of control in Ireland by Britain, the Gaelic-speaking Catholic Irish people, especially during the penal laws of the late 18th century, they weren't allowed to hold certain types of property, they weren't allowed to own weapons, they weren't allowed to hold professions, go to university. There were all these restrictions. And so a stick was something they were still allowed to have.
Yeah.
Some of the research that John Hurley has done suggests that there were some kind of overlaps with the idea of single stick or sticks as a training weapon for sword fighting.
Okay.
But it became its own thing because they weren't then using swords.
Okay.
They were continuing to use sticks. And so the stick was developed as a weapon in some different ways that separates it from training for sword fighting.
Hmm.
But I mean, certainly there were a lot of deaths in faction fighting.
Hmm.
There was an interesting historical source written by a doctor talking about different types of trauma that people experienced from faction fighting, a lot of head trauma, yes. Because that was the primary target, and that people didn't always die immediately, but they might die later because, you know, they would get an infection or they'd have a fractured skull and their brain would swell, or it's kind of a gory sport. But
what about longer staffs? Is there a quarter staff tradition, or I guess there probably would have been, but maybe that was more of a medieval thing.
There's less of a tradition of it that has survived till now. So there's a few styles, two main ones and some other periphery ones that I've heard about that all focus on the sort of 3.5 to 4 foot long shillelagh walking stick, like the one I made for you there that you were showing earlier.
Yep. Yeah.
That's the quintessential shillelagh. But historically, there was a range of sticks that went all the way from a kippeen, which is kind of like a little stick, the sort of short one with the knob. You still see those in tourist shops.
Yes.
All the way up to quarterstaff length ones and even longer, like sort of spear length sticks. Right. And there's names for all of them. John Hurley has done a categorization. I think it's up on his Shillelagh University website with all the Gaelic names and then how they translate and the sizes of the different sticks.
Okay. So, you continue.
The one that was most common was the walking stick length one, because you can carry it around unassumingly. It's a kind of a hidden weapon. And that's something that comes out in the songs and poems that I found as well, was this duality between a walking stick, which you can carry around everywhere and has a lot of other functions, and that same stick also being a weapon.
Yeah. And so this project is ongoing. I guess you'll try and get back to Ireland, or have you got access? Are you looking more at the diaspora now? You found the Doyle family. You sent me some of their videos a while back, and it was very interesting. And it looked so much like many other types of stick fight in that. I wondered whether, that in that process of formalization of stick fighting, that it was borrowing from a wide range of contemporary practices rather than necessarily being some sort of straightforward kind of continuity of an unbroken tradition.
Well, I think that tradition is a very murky area, but the way a lot of ethnomusicologists think about it is not in that invented tradition, it has never changed and it is ancient and all that sort of thing, but rather as the continuity of change. And I think the Doyle style, from my study with Glenn Doyle, is pretty conservative that way, that there's techniques and stories that are attached to people within the family, and here's how that technique was developed and here's why. And if you get into it a bit, it's all the relationship with faction fighting and other styles of Irish stick fighting that kind of explain the way techniques are and why they're like that. But, on another level, a stick is a stick and people only have two hands. And so there's bound to be things that are going to look similar.
And then I guess we return to the question of music. So the thing I mentioned, the thing that distracted me this afternoon, when I was rummaging around on the website, I'll go back to it. Where is it? Go back to this. Was your own music? So the music website is your. Is there any relation? So your alter ego is Ronan Evil. So that sounds to me like you do make some connection with martial arts, if only in the sense that you have no master and you are, I don't know, from a town or something. But is there anything martial in your music?
Well, I'm not like a battle DJ, so I'm not going head to head and scratching to achieve glory or anything like that. I suppose the Ronin part of it is because I've been interested in martial arts my whole life, right? And as a producer, I tend not to really follow styles. And maybe part of it is because whenever I've tried to do so, it just ends up sounding like my own stuff. And I find it a bit difficult to kind of do exactly what other people are doing. So it's that kind of idea of not being beholden to a master, a stylistic master in this case. I don't sort of go around sampling Kung Fu movies the way the Wu-Tang Clan does or anything like that. So no, there's not as much of a direct connection between my music production and martial arts, unfortunately. Okay. Unfortunately for martial arts studies.
So what's next for Colin Maguire then? What's in the pipeline? Any publications, or you want to just get back to your Irish stick fighting and music research, or what's the next thing?
There's a few things in the pipeline. One of which is an edited volume that I've been invited to contribute a chapter for on research ethics in ethnomusicology. So I'm slowly working on this chapter, talking about the ethics of apprenticeship. And of course, my point of entry into this is having had to apprentice in Kung Fu in order to learn the drum at Hong Luk. And the way that that has woven me into the fabric of the lineage. Mm-hmm. My name is now on lists at the club. They don't really do belts and that sort of thing, which is more Japanese really, but there are still hierarchies within the system. And it's like once I have become a part of this lineage, I find myself unable to really leave. I'm still in touch with the people at Hong Luk. I still help out with things to do with their web presence. Mm-hmm. I still think of my publications on Hong Luk as a contribution to their goal of preserving and promoting traditional Chinese martial arts. Mm-hmm. But there's other ethical issues that come up with that. And I think it's something that a lot of other martial arts researchers have encountered or will encounter. And that has to do with secret knowledge or knowledge, which is not necessarily secret, but it's not meant to be open to people who aren't at a certain level. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that raises issues of representation and publication. How do I represent this tradition that I've spent all this time learning, but also that my teachers have spent all this time teaching me? They've mm-hmm. invested a serious amount of energy into developing my skills. Mm-hmm. And that sort of body lineage means that when I practice Kung Fu, I can still hear my teacher's voice in my head. Yeah. When I do a move a certain way, and I know that's how my teacher did it, I can feel his movement in my body, even though he's already passed on. And so we'll see how that chapter comes about. I've definitely taken up some strategies in terms of the way that I've published, and I've had to negotiate a lot of things with senior members at the Hong Luk Kung Fu Club to get permission as far as what I can and can't publish. Mm-hmm. For the Irish stick fighting stuff, I'm really at this point still at a very preliminary organizational sort of phase of the research. I grabbed so much stuff in those 6 weeks in Ireland, which I'm still trying to catalog and categorize and read and cross-reference and follow up with. So eventually I'll definitely publish something on that, if only on my blog. But it would be nice to publish something open access, say in the Journal of Musicology in Ireland, or I know that the RTE, the national broadcaster in Ireland, has a format where they publish academic work, but for the general populace. And I think a lot of people in Ireland don't even know that Irish stick fighting still exists. They think, if they know about it, that it died out in the 1800s. And so I'd definitely like to publish something there and sort of work to reposition Irish stick fighting as a legitimate martial art for the 21st century, which is what the people who are practicing it are trying to do, to decolonize the narrative about it, to show the skill and the technique that goes into it, to show the culture that surrounded it in the 19th century, to show the music that has come out of it, some of which is still extant and in the tradition. Yeah, there's a few things on the go. It's definitely slowed down a bit because I have been forced to work for a living outside of academia. And I've had a bit more time lately, thanks to lockdown and being laid off from my job as a knife seller and knife sharpener.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some things on the go.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Well, Colin, thank you so much. It's always great talking to you, and it's good to see you again. And hopefully we'll meet again in a real way soon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. I look forward to seeing you again too.